Colonel Corbine, Reel 3. Now, if we can go back a bit in the Second World War, back to the period leading up to Normandy, can you tell me what job you had in relation to the opening of the so-called Second Front?
Yes, after my stint in West Africa, I went back to West Africa after the East African campaign, much to my regret. I went to Sierra Leone and lived in a camp in the back of Beyond for a bit of time. And then fortunately I was sent to the Staff College in England in August 1943. So I came home on in a convoy with a lot of people. My luggage was on a different ship, and that got torpedoed, so I lost all my luggage, which was rather a blow because I had a lot of cliff glass and things like that. But anyway, I was glad I didn't have to swim for it. And I went to the Staff College for, I think it was a 3-month course. At the end of that, I got one of the best jobs going, which was brigade major to an infantry brigade, which was part of the invasion force. And it was eventually based at Knepp Castle in Sussex, which used to be a girls' school, and a very nice setting for those of us to live in, particularly those who lived in awful conditions in West Africa. So I was a brigade major, and then when the invasion started, we were part of 43rd Division. My brigade incidentally was 214 Infantry Brigade, and the division was the 43rd Wyvern Division, with a lot of West Country soldiers. We were supposed to be a follow-up division, that is, there were two assault divisions in the attack on Normandy, and then there were some follow-up divisions, and then the reinforcement divisions. Well, we were supposed to be in the second wave, so to speak, and eventually we went to an area of the docks of East London to stay in a final camping site before embarking, according to what shipping was available. And two things I always remember about that were, first of all, the kindness of all the East Enders, who turned out in their thousands, in spite of the fact they must have been already in many convoys passing through the East End, but they managed to find tea and milk and sugar, and they sort of provided us with cups of tea on the way, because it was a very slow journey. Anyway, we got to this campsite, and while we were waiting, the first V1s started arriving in London, so we had the first experience of those, and I must say it was quite a fascinating experience, so it was the very first one. Because you heard the noise of an aeroplane, what sounded like a rather pathetic aeroplane flying through, not too far above you, and suddenly it would stop, and then about a matter of seconds later, there would be an almighty crump, and in effect, well, some poor soldiers have seen the dust, or bitten the dust now. And we were there for really several days, which we shouldn't have been, but there was a very bad storm in the channel, which has been well recorded already. And so the shipping and the follow-up divisions were badly delayed. Eventually we got on a small ship with my brigade headquarters and sailed through the Straits of Dover during the night, because the Germans were shelling Dover at that time. And certainly quite a number of shells passed over while we were passing through, and Deborah was copying it. And it was still quite rough, and this ship we were on was a very small freighter, I would say, and we lived in pretty good squalor. and living on compo rations, the same sort of compo rations, day after day, as not very appetizing. When we got to the coast of France, nobody knew until really the last moment where we were going to land, and I'm afraid I can't remember the name of the place that we did land in the end, but we had a dry landing at least, so we were able to disembark onto a pier, a sort of jetty, and walk ashore rather than having to wade ashore with typewriters and all the rest of the things the headquarters had. And I have to express admiration of the way the administration of the invasion was handled, because it was so well marked where drivers or where vehicles and drivers should meet up to go on with their journeys wherever that took them to. And the arrangements for people to tie up with their different units or which might be on different ships was really very wonderfully organized. And I always remember the CEO of the Suffolk who landed on D-Day saying, what impressed him most was when he landed, or soon after he landed, he lost his command track carrier vehicle, because it went over a mine or something, and he got a new one within a matter of hours. So I think, on the whole, whatever shortcomings there may have been, it was a magnificently organized operation. The 214 Brigade eventually went inland when we collected all our vehicles and got ourselves sorted out. But the Bridgehead, of course, was very small still in those days, and there were literally thousands of guns and probably hundreds of thousands of soldiers and vehicles. And the German Luftwaffe was very active at night time. They couldn't fail to hit something whenever they dropped a bomb. And of course, the suffering vehicles like lorries bore the brunt of the problem because their tires were easily punctured. And the lorry was not available for due purpose until the new tires had been found. It was a very uncomfortable time in the future, I have to say. And I think it lasted for several weeks until the Americans managed to break out in the West.
What were your main responsibilities as brigade major, and what were your main problems?
Well, my responsibilities were as the right-hand man of the brigadier, and to arrange all the meetings and all the groups or the commanding officers of the battalions, to organize the brigade headquarters itself to see if it was running properly and its communications were working and all that sort of thing. It was mainly clerical and sort of doing one stint on the command wireless set, because the command wireless set had to be manned all the time, obviously. And there were two other officers and myself, and then three liaison officers who we all had to take it in turn. But if anything happened, of course I was woken up. Anyway, I found it extremely difficult to sleep because of the noise at night. Oh, throughout the 24 hours, really, with all our guns blazing off at every opportunity, and the ground shaking, so if you lay on the ground, put your head down, you're liable to get a black eye if you lay with your face down. And of course the Germans were well supplied with ammunition, and by that time they'd reacted very strongly in our area to the advance into France, because that was the most attractive area, I think, for the Allies to attack over the rather flat country of the Northern Europe.
What was the attitude of people, the Normandy civilians, to you?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that, because I was pretty shattered by a French farmer. I did speak a bit of French, and I was talking to this French farmer, and he said, in 4 years of German occupation, I never lost anything. In 14 days of liberation, I lost all my cattle, my house has been looted and destroyed. And I thought that was a terrible indictment of the British soldier. Because no doubt an awful lot of looting did go on to all the houses, we passed through all the farmsteads. And although in theory one ought to have put a stop to it, I mean, how long would have been locked up if the group tried to do anything about it? Because all we wanted to do was to defeat Hitler. But I think that remark by the French farmer probably denotes, because every field, I don't think there were ever any live cattle. I've no doubt the way, in fact, but all I can remember is cows lying on their back, bellies in the air, terribly inflated, and swelling to high end, until eventually there had to be special troops got together to burn them or bury them.
Was this farmer trying to get compensation from you?
Well, it was very early days then. I mean, I don't even cross his mind, but I hope he did in the end. But then every farmer would have had to apply for it. And I think it was probably just regarded in the end as an act of war. And I don't suppose they did get any compensation. But I'm not at all knowledgeable about how they restocked their farms or rebuilt their houses. I have to say that I think they lived pretty well under the Germans in the countryside. The towns were a different matter, and they had a terrible time. I think in the countryside, they went to their war for rations and food and that sort of thing. Because, of course, they lived on farmland and were able to able to look after themselves to some extent.
Did you say anything to this farmer when he made the complaint?
Well, I did, I think, express shock and disgust, and what can one say?
What happened to you next?
Well, we still unfortunately forget, eventually moved forward. I mean, the history of North West Europe shows how difficult it was to break out in that particular area of France, and it wasn't until the Americans had made a lot of progress in big incessant movements to the south that we eventually managed to break out, or the British and Canadians eventually managed to break out of their Britain. And then there was, of course, that famous battle of the Falaise Gap, where enormous numbers of Germans were slaughtered. Not only by the RAF, but by the army as well. But I mean, that's not part of my story, because I wasn't there and I didn't even see it. But as a brigade major, on the whole, I didn't see a lot of what was going on, except at the same crossing. Same crossing, I think it was this. The one battalion of the 43rd Division was given the job of getting across the Seine at one place, and unfortunately the maps are not very accurate, so they crossed this place and they landed on an island. Meantime, there are salt boats which they used to get to this island before they realised it was an island. They'd gone back to fetch more troops. So it was a bit of a mess up altogether. But they did eventually get across. But apart from incessant shelling by the Germans, I can't say how they took part or saw anything very memorable at that stage. And then eventually I went as second in command to the 4th Battalion of the Wiltshire Regiment, and in that row, I was left out of battle when there was a battle. That meant that I had to go to the back somewhere and await to hear news of my commanding officer if he was killed or wounded, and I would go up and replace him. And I eventually did replace him. I'm glad to say he wasn't killed or wounded, but he was suffering from shell shock, and I had to go up and take over command in the middle of the night with the battalion just having completed an attack on the position. And that was rather a testing first experience to find my way around in the dark where all my rifle couplers were and see what the situation was. However, that was just the start of things.
Where did you take over? Whereabouts was this?
I'm afraid I can't remember. I think it was somewhere in Holland. It sounds awful to say I don't remember, but I passed through so many places. I probably only spent maybe a day or a night in each one, or even less sometimes, as it's very difficult to remember now at this stage.
Were you in the attempt to push through to Arnhem?
Yes, the 43rd Division was part of the column that went up along a single road to relieve the airborne troops at Arnhem. I was commanding the battalion by then, and I must say we all thought the plan was quite unattainable at the time, which is a bad way of looking at things. But the 4th Wiltshire was supposed, in the end, to go right up into Holland, cross another river there, which was quite substantial, and I can't remember which one, and hold a bridgehead on the eastern side of the river against any German attack. Well, there were something like 3 divisions going up this single road, and there was utter chaos in the way of the vehicles. I mean, you were supposed to keep, I think it was 50 yards between the vehicles. Well, they were crammed together like sardines. And of course, at various stages, the Germans managed to assemble a few troops and put in an attack on some of these stationary columns, mainly of subskin vehicles, like 3-ton trucks and supply trucks. So they did a good deal of damage, and of course, it took a long time to get things put right. But eventually we did get up to just short of Arnhem on the other side of the canal, of the river rather. And we heard the desperate situation that the airborne troops were in, and the Dorset regiment from the 43rd Division had the unenviable task of taking boats across in the night to try and rescue some of the airborne troops. And in the end, I think the Dorsets lost almost as many men as the airborne troops in relation to their size. But of course, you never hear anything about the Dorset regiment, because the main interest is in the airborne forces. I must say, it was a very hairy time that we did realise, I mean, pretty soon, I think everybody realised from the General Montgomery downwards that we were never going to achieve the final objective, however desirable it might have been, because Arnhem and that area was very difficult. All the ground was waterlogged between the two rivers, the Maas and the
Rhine.
And it was waterlogged, and the only means of getting across it was along the embankments. So, of course, you were sitting duck for a German anti-tank gun, or any tank that showed itself was blown to pieces. And people suffered an enormous number of casualties. I can't really remember more about that particular time.
What happened to your battalion after Arnhem?
at Arnhem.
No, after Arnhem.
Well, they had to get into this boggy area where they had a lot of casualties, and eventually we captured the whole area and came out the other side somehow. That's sadly depleted. And then I think we came back to the western side, to the west side of the Rhine, to take part in the assault across the Rhine. And for that, we were given things called buffaloes, which were tanks without their turrets and without all the inners, but they did provide protection, and they'd been made waterproof so they could swim across the Rhine. Well, the Rhine was a pretty large river in those days, because of the winter coming on. So it was a very interesting experience to go across in these buffaloes. And we eventually got across. By then, I think that the Germans were crumbling on a bit. And there was an awful lot of opposition during that time. And actually, after crossing.
But before this, hadn't you been involved in the Reichswald battles?
Oh, yes, we had a very rough time in the Reichswald forest, yes.
What do you remember about that?
Well, it was the Reichswald Forest is an enormous area of fir trees, and it's very unpleasant to be shelled in those conditions because the shells burst in the foliage of the trees. So anybody underneath, unless it's very well dug in, is a goner. And we had to sit in the Reichswald Forest, or very near to it, for quite a number of days, carrying out patrols.
I think your battalion was involved in the capture of Cleve, was it not?
Yes. We were somewhere in a large town in Germany, near a few miles from Cleve, when I was told that the 4th Luftwaffe had to go and attack Cleve. Cleve, I may say, was a medium-sized town, and it had been bombed by the RAF with very large bombs, 500 pounders, either the previous night or certainly not more than 48 hours before. So the roads and the houses were in a pretty bad way, and the roads in particular, when there was a 500-pound bomb, had almost disappeared, although the Germans had put white tape down some of the craters so that if you were wary, you could probably get round without too much trouble. Anyway, I had my orders to do this attack sometime at night, so we got involved as it was pouring with rain, and the other great obstacle was that the Rhine, the embankments of the Rhine had been knocked down, so the countryside was flooding, and the floods were increasing all the time. And at this stage, they were probably about, well, they varied with the country, of course, but they were passable to all vehicles, but the water was rising. And it was raining, and it was dark, and the maps were not at all good. And we were told, or I was told, that there was some armored cars had got to the edge of Cleve, and then had to go back because there was enemy fire. And so we went along the road to Cleve, and we were helped to some extent by use of artificial moonlight, and artificial moonlight was supplied by searchlight units shining the searchlights on the clouds above, which gave a certain amount of light in an otherwise extremely black storms last night. Well, we went along these roads, going through, especially through the water, and eventually got to where the armored cars were held up, and there were roadblocks there, so we had to get out of our vehicles and clear the various roadblocks and dig out one or two very gallant, unfortunate Germans who had been left behind with an anti-tank weapon to take at least one tank to them when the moment of departure to the next world came. But they managed to find them before they actually hit any tank. And anyway, the tanks couldn't operate at night, so the really were in a lost cause at that stage. So they might have got a vehicle like this, the Ares carrier or another carrier. Well, we got to the edge of the sea and had a short skirmish there and took a few prisoners, and then got into the route, or the main route, into Kiev from this direction. There were quite a lot of roads into Kiev. And as I said earlier, the road was very badly damaged. And of course, the vehicles had a terrible time trying to get round these huge craters. And they were slipping into the craters and having to be winched out. So it was a very long, drawn out and difficult process. However, the infantry did get into Kiev. No enemy opposition was met at all. The opposition was all from the elements and the bombing. And we really spread out along a single road for about, I suppose, about a mile. So it's rather like a skewer into the southern half of Kiev. And then we stopped there because I felt it was better just to hold the place. I had a particularly infuriating acting brigadier who kept getting on the wireless to me when I was trying to organize the clearance of the roadblocks. And he kept on saying, "Get on, get on, get on," which was the war cry of every commander. And in the end, I really got terribly angry. I said, "Well, if you come out here and take a look yourself, you'll see it's not all that easy to get on." And he came up next day and he put me into a DSO, which I didn't get. anyway, that's by the way. Well, we stuck there, as I say, as a skewer, and remained there until another battalion arrived from the south side. The 7th Somerset came up to do some other task. But in the meantime, I eventually, surely, I think by chance, got news that the 15th Scottish Division was going to attack Kiev from the north. And they apparently didn't know that we were already in the southern part of Kiev. So frantic messages were sent on the radio, saying, "For goodness sake, don't attack the southern part of Kiev. Anyway, there don't appear to be any Germans here. And we are already in Kiev." So that was eventually sorted out. And then somebody else took over the advance from us until the next stage. I mean, all the way along from Kiev onwards, there were various battles, and the 4th Works were holding a position whose name I'm afraid I can't